you see the divisions between serious classical music and pop music and jazz and rock as being artificial when they're used as boundaries of the way you're supposed to discuss something. You think all the music should be taken equally seriously or has the potential to be serious music. What kind of boundaries do you face at the New York Times?
Well, let me rephrase your question for a second.
Why don't you?
And that is that I think these boundaries can be artificial in particular cases. And I do think that everything should be approached with an equal seriousness, or nearly everything. I got into a discussion the other day about somebody with Barry Manilow, but we'll move right along here. That most everything can be approached with an equal seriousness. But I don't think that, I mean, it would be silly to pretend that rock and academic serial music were the same thing. I mean, they are all music, and they are all these different forms are worthy of equal seriousness. At the same time, they have different audiences, different sociological and patronage structures, different traditions, and it would be equally silly to pretend that they didn't exist. So it's not that I'm arguing that we're all in one sort of happy melange and, hey, man, it's all music and you know, you think too much, Jack, or whatever people say to music critics. Now, as far as the New York Times is concerned, I mean, the New York Times, I think, is no better, or in fact, it is better, but it's no qualitatively different in this regard than a lot of other newspapers and arts organizations. Certain traditions have grown up of departmental structures which reflect traditional views of how these things exist. When I came to the New York Times as a stringer in 1972, a stringer being somebody who's paid by the piece rather than a staff employee, they had one person as a stringer, one jazz critic they'd had for a long time, John Wilson, who's still there, and they'd had a shifting succession of stringers who covered the rock beat from sort of the mid-60s on. But when I became the rock critic the chief rock critic in 1974, when I was still a stringer, and then was hired on staff, I was also doing classical, but I was the first staff music critic in the history of the New York Times to cover vernacular music of any kind as a regular beat. Now we have a positive army of them in the sense that I've sort of moved into a kind of emeritus status in rock, but Palmer's now come on staff as Robert Palmer as the chief rock critic, and we have a couple of other rock jazz type stringers, and then Wilson is still there. So there's a real group of them now. As far as my confronting these barriers is concerned, I mean, let us face facts. There is a certain problem there in that when I gave up formally being the chief rock critic in 1980, it was partly because I just didn't want to be responsible for every Styx and Foreigner concert that came along and answering every rock press agent who wanted to hype me an interview with Culture Club or whatever. But that doesn't mean that I lost interest in it. Yet by bringing Bob Palmer, who is somebody that I brought onto the paper and who's a friend of mine, in as rock critic, there's a slight toe-stepping problem there because, in other words, I can't just blithely wander around in any area, classical or pop, and do any damn thing I want. And in an ideal world, I would like to be able to sort of just spontaneously cover absolutely anything I wanted to. It's not quite as simple as that, and there is still a slight bias on the part of the higher editors of the paper towards traditional classical music, and it's regarded as sort of slightly, I think they're sort of bemused by me. On the one hand, they think it's interesting and unusual that I can cover and like to cover and want to cover jazz and popular music and so forth. On the other hand, I think they think it's slightly déclassé. And so I don't know quite how they respond to that, but it's not a serious problem, and such problems as it is are reflected in other American newspapers, I think.
So you think they think that if you're listening to rock, you're slumming?
Well, I think that to broaden it beyond the specific internal politics of the New York Times for a minute, that this is a general problem. That and it's not just classical snobs about rock. It can work very much the other way.
Yes.
In other words, rock, there's a whole syndrome of rock people who think basically, even if they might give a little grudging lip service to the idea of serious music, that the rest of this stuff is either is essentially, as I refer to it somewhere in the book, is a played-out amusements of the ruling classes, and that essentially classical music is an archaic, dead form, often performed by the wrong race, i.e. whites. And conversely, the classical music people, as you suggest, really do think that rock musicians are barbarians. And then jazz intelligentsia, as far as I can see, is paranoid and polemical on both fronts. In other words, they regard themselves as the true American classical music, and that regular classical music is a kind of a dead European import on the one hand, and on the other hand, they regard themselves as threatened by all this cheap commercial music on the other, so that everybody is defensive and hence aggressive about other musical forms. And one of the reasons I wrote this book was not to argue a kind of bland tolerance of everything, but to argue that, in fact, some of these polemical barriers are simply impede people from appreciating different kinds of music that they could happily appreciate across these barriers.
Through which kind of music did you enter music?
Well, basically through classical. In other words, when I was a little child, my parents had the odd collection of records around, from Burl Ives to Peter and the Wolf to Broadway shows and Oklahoma and so forth. But I took piano lessons as a child. And then, I was thinking about this the other day, I then avocationally, when I was like 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, I was more interested in popular music than anything else. I did listen to the Hit Parade. This was all along in the days before rock and roll. And then I remember being obsessed with Tennessee Ernie Ford's 16 Tons
me
and
too.
Early Elvis. And
That song used to frighten me, actually.
Right. Oh, yeah. I mean, it's a scary, powerful song, a real kind of pre-rock populist anthem there. But in any case, and early Elvis and so forth. And then right in the mid-50s, no disrespect to Elvis, mind you, I really got involved with classical music, and through Toscanini, really, and started collecting a lot of Toscanini records, and then was really concentrated on classical music in the late 50s and early mid-60s. And when I started getting into journalism, which was at my college radio station and then on KPFA, the Pacific station in Berkeley, I was mostly doing broadcasts and criticism about opera. And then when I was in Berkeley in the 60s, I was drawn back into the worlds of contemporary music of all different kinds, from experimental music to rock to jazz. And from then on, it's been a kind of a balance.
John Rockwell, New York Times music critic, is my guest, and we're going to talk about his book, All American Music, which is his new book. Let's get to the book. You started with a discussion of several serialist composers. Would you describe what serialism is for our listeners who aren't familiar with the term?
Well, serialism is a method of organization of the chromatic scale. It's kind of a... It is a tricky issue to explain, but I mean, Western music in the even-tempered scale consists of 12 notes, counting the octave duplication. And the conventional method of organization of these notes in the normal kind of classical music that you hear is the harmonic system, in which music plays in a key, returns to a home note within that key, and then can modulate into different keys. Gradually, in the course of the late 19th century, composers introduced ever greater chromatic disruptions of this sort of simple and neat pattern. I mean, the classic clarity of the harmonic system perhaps can be observed in somebody like Haydn. And in the course of the 19th century, it got trickier and trickier. So when you get to, say, Wagner's Tristan and Isolde, you don't know what key you're in for long stretches of time. And when you get into the early 20th century with works like Schoenberg's Transfigured Night and so forth, you really are in a kind of atonal miasma. And from this, in the early 20s, Schoenberg himself evolved this 12-tone theory, which was essentially a way of formalizing abstraction, of lending a kind of organizational credence to what would otherwise be perceived as the psychologically threatening implications of total anarchy in the harmonic system. What it is a kind of system for abstraction, for sonic abstraction. And since Schoenberg worked out his earlier theories of it, this has been extended by other composers into the areas of dynamics and rhythm and so forth, so that a so-called total serial piece, which is what in many ways Milton Babbitt, my second chapter, concerns himself with, you really have this almost maniacal systematization extended to all areas of music.
Do you enjoy serial music?
Well, I mean, I don't like to think that I enjoy or don't enjoy anything as a total genre. I think the great works of serial music, I've been a little surprised that some of the reviews of this book have suggested that I am just taking a battle axe to serialism and sort of blasting it out of the way before I move on to other kinds of music. And that's really not true. I do think that in the northeast of the United States, in the last 20 years, there's been a tendency, partly based on career political success of some of these people, for the grimmer kinds of serialist music of its in its more tepid academic variety to become overly predominant on new serious new music programs. But that doesn't mean that the best of it isn't absolutely wonderful, either by Europeans or by Americans. So I don't like to get branded in public as an enemy of serialism. I do think that a lot of the lesser lights of serialism have turned out boring music, but then again, there's been pretty boring music turned out by non-serialists, too.
It always interests me when some kind of like radical change from the past becomes a genre after other people become followers of that change. I guess that happened in serial music.
How do you mean by radical? I don't understand quite.
Well, you take a radical change. Someone departs radically from the kind of music that's happened before.
Yeah.
And other people start following them, and this radical change becomes institutionalized, a formula,
becomes
a genre.
Absolutely, or worse than a genre, it becomes a cliche.
A cliche, yes.
And that really does happen, and it's kind of sad with serialism, because serialism, for anybody who really follows this kind of music now, really is the province of, I think, a kind of academic sensibility, yet to realize that in the 20s it was the province of the brightest and best kind of romantic expressionist rebels, and that then the enemy was a kind of flatulent late romanticism with, talk about cliche, I mean, the kind of boring gestures and elephantine orchestras and pathetic appeals to cheesy emotions and so forth. And in comparison with that, serialism represented this kind of cool, brisk, impassioned kind of counterstatement. Also, the fact that it isn't ironic that the visual arts of our time are dominated by varying forms of abstraction. We are so used to appealing, sometimes even on a decorative level, but also on a deeply emotional level, any kind of abstraction from the kind of Jackson Pollock kind of abstraction to sort of formalist abstraction to abstract expressionism with its sort of violent emotional qualities. And all of these things are sort of exactly paralleled by various forms of serialism and other kinds of musical modernism, which have enjoyed nowhere near the kind of popular acceptance that the visual equivalents have. Now, there are some reasons for that, but I would just sort of urge people who have an instinctive resistance to what they perceive as dissonant, ugly music, but who may even secretly like some of these painting schools that I've been referring to approach the music in the spirit of the painting and see how far they get with it.
Let's listen to a selection from Milton Babbitt's Philomel. Do you want to say something about this before we hear it? We'll hear an excerpt.
Yeah, I mean, this is a piece for soprano and computer-generated echo of her voice plus computer sounds. It's extremely abstract, but in my view, the very poetic and appealing as well, approached sort of perhaps in the sort of intuitive way that I just suggested. It's also a rather metaphorically wonderful setting of the text, because the recurrent line is, I am becoming my own song. And so the soprano voice kind of dissolves into these electronic twitterings and echoings that Babbitt creates with the synthesizer.
Let's hear it. Is it serious? I feel.
I feel trees in my hair, and on the ground, honey melons.
An excerpt of Milton Babbitt's Philomel. My guest, if you're just joining us, is New York Times rock critic, New York Times music critic. It's the rock from Rockwell that.
Well, also the fact that I was the rock critic.
That's right. And his new book is called All American Music, and it's about several 20th century composers in different fields, jazz, rock, and new music. Well, Babbitt, who we just heard from.
It's actually about the whole field. Using those composers is illustrative.
Good, thank you. Babbitt has said, he wrote an essay saying, "Who cares if you listen?" What do you think his attitude was towards his audience, and what was he reacting against?
This essay was entitled by the magazine, he wanted to call it The Composer as Specialist, but it's the classic, it's usually cited by people as the classic example of the kind of arrogant, piggish attitude on the part of these upstart composers. In fact, what he really was saying in this essay, or is saying in this essay, is a kind of extension of the romantic notion. In other words, in the 18th century, the artist wore the same uniform as the butler and provided music for his courtly patron or churchly patron. And of course, the 19th century, you had this kind of Promethean or Daedalus-like notion of the artist who would be this independent spirit scorning the bourgeois world. Well, in a sense, Babbitt's position in Who Cares If You Listen is a 20th century extension of that. He argues that the composer operates under his own laws. He's operating in an area of complexity and specialization that is not for the common herd. And if the common herd is interested in it, it's their job to become sophisticated in the ways that the composer is working rather than the composer's job to write music that appeals to the public.
Do you think that composers who came along in the next generation reacted against that? As he reacted
that,
against what had come
that
from
attitude,
him?
But also that level of complexity in music. In other words, these things tend, as in all things, to kind of have a pendulum effect back and forth between different styles and extremes. And I think that right now we are really in the midst of a reaction against not only the aesthetic and sociological attitude expressed in that essay, but in the density and of expression and inaccessibility of intent and result of this whole generation of post-serialist. I mean, the total serialist and semi-serialist and composers of that have dominated especially Northeastern American music since the Second World War. David Del Tredici is an example of that because he started out being trained at Princeton where Sessions and Babbitt were teaching, yet in recent years has had a rather violent reaction within his own work against that degree of rigor.
You quote him as saying, "For my generation, it's considered vulgar to have an audience really like a piece on first hearing."
I know. I mean, it really, he actually can be rather poignant in talking about these kinds of things. And he winds up, that was an interview that I quote in the book that I had done with him originally in the New York Times. And he winds up saying that the whole situation really is very Alice in Wonderland, where everything turned on its head. And that, of course, makes sense for him, since for the last 10 years or so, he's been obsessed with Lewis Carroll texts. And everything he's done has been a setting of varying aspects of the Alice stories.
Do you see him as being indicative of composers today returning to romanticism or
sure.
returning to whatever?
Sure. I mean, the whole phrase "return to romanticism," which was coined by Harold Schoenberg at the Times, and in his case, I think, really meant almost a literal return to music that sounded like the 19th century, which in the case of George Rochberg is exactly what he's done. But of course, the term return to romanticism can have a much broader meaning. It could mean anything that's sort of tuneful and accessible, but it even can mean something that's violent and emotionally moving, even if still dissonant. But what it means is not so much a return to accessibility as a return to emotionality and overt expressiveness in music, as opposed to a kind of more abstract patterning.
Just to illustrate some of Del Tredici's music, we have, I think, pretty randomly selected something from Final Alice. Do you want to say something about it?
Well, Final Alice is the best known of all these various Alice pieces that Del Tredici has written, all of them for soprano, soloist, and a large orchestra. And really, they could be sort of almost knit together into a kind of a larger opera, although he hasn't quite brought himself to composing opera yet, although why he hasn't is beyond me, I must say, because he really has a dramatic sensibility. But what you have here is a kind of Straussian-sized and textured symphony orchestra with soprano soloist who takes all the parts, narrator and Alice and so forth. And one peculiarity is that in concert, the orchestra is so large and the soprano type that he picks, not being Birgit Nielsen, is more of a lyric soprano to capture the childlike qualities of the text and the characters. And so the soprano has to be amplified, and which can often sound rather tinny. In that sense, hearing this on recording is better because the balances can be artificially adjusted by the recording engineers.
Okay, so this is a selection from David Del Tredici's final Alice. Selection from David Del Tredici's final Alice. Well, so there's more accessible or melodic things happening in there. How popular would you say he is? Has he reached a different kind of audience than his serialist predecessors?
Well, I mean, there's so many different ways you can measure popularity. I mean, and also classical music and jazz having, as they do, a kind of tiny slice of the commercial pie. He's not popular in the sense that he's gone platinum. On the other hand, the record of Final Alice did type top record world's classical music sales chart one week, for what that's worth. And when these pieces are performed in public, they get a big, hearty, standing ovation-type response. Yet, an irony that I point out in the book is that Del Tredici has not been absolutely deluged with commissions or performances of these pieces. There's a kind of suspicion on the—I mean, there's a lot of possible reasons for that. The suspicion on the part of some conservative people that these aren't very good. I mean, there's this kind of repetition of tunes and static harmonies and so forth that strike some people, for all the orchestral craft going on, as simplistic. There is a resentment on the part of people who write very complex intellectual music when people write simpler music, especially when those people have come from that background. They're regarded as Judases. And also, as I say, every one of these chapters is in part about the subject, but is also about larger issues that are suggested or epitomized by the subject. And so in my Del Tredici chapter, I try to sort of get into a discussion of the paradoxical cross-purposes at which symphony orchestras find themselves when they try to select whatever token new music they choose to put on their programs every year. And the fact is that very few people who are in the position to make those decisions, i.e. the foreign-born music director, whoever he may be, or the plutocratic board members, or the careerist-minded orchestra management — I'm painting this all in dark terms, but just for purposes of drama — none of these people really necessarily has any strong feelings or even interest in or liking for contemporary music. And so they pick things on the most bizarre basis, on the basis of local career politics, whoever the most sort of actively hustling local university composer may be, or on the basis of whatever was prestigious success in Europe that they read about, or, you know, in other words, there's all sorts of reasons that tend to make for a series of prestigious looking, practically boring premieres that come up every season and then pretty much are forgotten. And Del Tredici appeals more viscerally to an audience, yet the very fact that he does can offend the kind of system that now exists that involved in this. And what I'm trying to suggest here is that the whole mechanism is a little moribund, and so therefore success can be threatening to the death wish of some of these people.
Mm-hmm. Where do you see Cage fitting in?
Well, so far we've been talking about total serialist academic intellectual composers of one kind, another, and a reaction sort of from within that camp into a kind of more accessible mainstream classical music. Now, Cage really represents both the summing up to his time and the launching platform for after his time, if I may mix my metaphors, of a different parallel tradition in American art music. It's a tradition that goes back at least as far as Ives, and arguably further than that. It was between Ives and Cage, the most important person is Henry Cowell. But it's a kind of iconoclastic, eccentric, non-European, all-American experimental tradition. One of the sub-themes of this book is a concentration on composers that I consider to be loners or outsiders or eccentrics, people who in different ways, depending on their traditions, refused to accept what was expected of them. And nowhere is this kind of tradition, which I think of as being somehow quintessentially American, is better exemplified than in this whole experimental tradition. Cage is a man whose role in summing up the kind of iconoclastic and individualistic tradition before him was augmented by his interest in things Oriental. In particular, not just that his music sounds like Oriental, the closest you can get to that is the prepared piano pieces of the 30s and 40s and early 50s, which have a certain kinship to Indonesian gamelan music. But the real impact of Orientalism, which was essentially Zen Buddhism and Tibetan Buddhism with the I Ching and so on, is more philosophical than it is strictly musical. It has to do with an opening up of attitude. It has to do with a tearing down of accepted rules and traditions. And Cage serves as a kind of icon of permissiveness. He allowed composers, especially in the 60s, who were influenced by his first collection of writings, Silence, which came out in 1961, he allowed composers the permission to really do any damn thing they choose. And as a result, people who can legitimately be called post-Cageans sound wildly different from one another and often wildly different from Cage. Cage, in turn, has written music that is wildly different in genre from piece to piece. I think that a lot of Cage's music is very interesting and very beautiful, but I think that the real impact of Cage will be philosophical and in terms of the sort of role model he set for a composer in society.
You devote one of your chapters to Frederick Rzhevsky, whose music has become kind of political, but you question whether the politics of it is really reaching the audience it's intended for.
Yeah, because Fred Rzhevsky is a man who started out kind of on the downtown scene and wrote kind of motoric minimalist pieces in the mid-late 60s, even some of them politically motivated even then about the Attica uprising in the early 70s and so forth. But in recent years, he's turned, without straitjacketing himself, he's still stylistically eclectic, essentially to a kind of neo-romantic music designed specifically to appeal to middle-class American classical music concertgoers. And the implication is that he has chosen this idiom not so much because he is driven to compose in this style for purely aesthetic reasons, but because he feels that this is the style that he can use to convey his political messages, which are essentially leftist, international type, you know, pro-Allende, Red China, those kinds of messages, anti-imperialist. And he's trying to convey these messages to an audience that would otherwise, he thinks, not really reach them. And the point that I'm trying to raise in the chapter is that there's a kind of something kind of self-defeating about Rzhevsky and the late British composer Cornelius Cardew and Christian Wolff, who's another ex-Cajun who's gotten into this thing now, of essentially they are not really moving anybody really with his music, however much people may appreciate it. They're not accomplishing any kind of significant political goals, and at the same time they're compromising their artistic impetus in the same way that another composer might be compromised by subscribing too readily to a commercial impetus. I think Shevsky is an enormously talented composer, but he justifies appealing to the old classical music audience on the grounds that in Western Europe and in America, the petty bourgeoisie is a kind of, as he puts it, is a kind of swing factor, that the workers are too oppressed by capitalism and the plutocrats are too co-opted by it, but that the petty bourgeoisie, if they can be persuaded, then that will tilt the whole mechanism of society and government in the proper political direction. But I think from a political standpoint, he's being naive, and I think that to some extent he is compromising the enormous talent he evinces as a musician. I also think that if you're going to be a political musician, why not just go with the idiom that appeals to the most people? In other words, I think that Bruce Springsteen, say in Nebraska, is making more effective political music than Fred Shevsky could ever hope to do with the current idiom in which he now works.
Well, let's hear the opening passage of one of his pieces, and we're going to hear the opening of The People United. Do you want to say a little bit about
The People United Will Never Be Defeated was a very popular song originally made by one of the Latin new song groups called Quilapayún, and it was an anthem for the Allende regime in Chile. And what Shevsky has done is done a kind of numerologically symmetrical set of 36 piano variations. And I won't go into the numerology of it, but it's all very neat. But it's essentially a kind of, although there are some dissonant passages, the dissonance tends to be used in the way that dissonance was traditionally used in 19th century Western music to introduce elements of drama. And basically you've got a kind of Brahmsian piano variations form. I mean, the idea of it is not all that different from Brahms' Handel variations, for instance. And as such, it's extremely accessible to people who basically dote on 19th century piano music.
Okay, this is Frederick Shevsky. An excerpt of Frederick Shevsky's The People United, and I guess you'd have to really work hard to figure out the political implications.
Except that the very nature of the song, the very choice of his material. I mean, he, for example, has a really wonderful piano piece called Four North American Ballads, which are all based on kind of working songs and folk songs of the 19th century, and that's really it in terms of the political motivation. Yet, and in that sense, when he is essentially confining his politics to the choice of materials. But see, it's a little more complicated because he is choosing his idiom on the basis of an ideology as well as his themes.
I think it's fair to say that electronic music really got started in new music, although it's now used in rock and jazz and pop.
Well, I mean, electronic music is in everything you hear. Everything on this program is electronic music. The very act of listening to the radio is an act of dealing with electronic music. There are three chapters in various ways in the book about electronic music, and I am a firm believer that the wave of the future in almost all areas is electronic, especially, quote, serious music. In other words, I can't imagine but that the evolution of technology and composers' interest in computer music, synthesizer music, and so forth is not just going to lead to an enormous... It already is happening in places like especially the Stanford Computer Music Center, but also UC San Diego and MIT and Brooklyn College. There's just an enormous explosion of interest and a competent simplification and less expensive, smaller, more compact kind of equipment is being made available to composers now. And it's just an enormous area. And I just think it's very important. It's also, as you suggested, very interesting as a particularly ready example of the kind of crossover potential of electronic sounds because, yes, it started in classical music and evolution in hi-fi equipment tends to start with the sophisticated classical music buyer. I mean, the initial software for the compact laser disc is apparently going to be largely classical, but it'll soon broaden out to pop. And in the case of electronic music, the interest of composers started in classical, but then the demand of rock bands and then of the consumer for cheap portable synthesizers and so forth has now doubled back into the serious realm and enabled composers with no commercial pretensions whatsoever to afford their own portable microcomputers and so forth. It's really a fascinating area, and I try to give some hint of it and some idea of how one can approach it and how different people in the book represent different areas of it.
I guess Philip Glass has become a bridge in a way between those two worlds.
Well, Philip Glass is a bridge between so many different worlds. I mean, he's not strictly an electronic music composer because he doesn't use synthesizers and computers, yet he does use electric organs. His music is entirely amplified except for the recent operas. And at the same time, he spans the gulf from downtown experimental music to literal rock and roll production and playing in clubs to writing operas. He really is the most small-c Catholic of almost anybody in the book, yet at the same time very focused on his own style.
My guest is John Rockwell, the New York Times music critic, if you're just joining us, and his new book is called All American Music, and it's just been published by Knopf. Well, your book is also devoted to jazz and rock composers, and let's talk a little bit about Ornette Coleman, whose music has really been recently crossing over into rock as well, but it's a different kind of fusion than what we'd call fusion music.
Coleman, once again, is none of these guys. I mean, he's not totally by accident. I mean, everybody in this book is picked partly because I like the music, but also because, as I say, they're representative. And like Glass, I mean, Coleman is a man who's written string quartets. He's written for the symphony orchestra. He's written funk. It's not exactly rock, but it's certainly funk-oriented jazz. And, of course, he pioneered free jazz. And, I mean, he's had a long and complicated career. And what interests me about Coleman, a lot of things. And the other thing, of course, is that he is as good an example psychologically and in terms of his own career as anybody in this book of this kind of sub-theme of the loner, outsider, eccentric. Because even though he's had an enormous impact on mainstream jazz and Martin Williams, for instance, argues that he is the mainstream of our time, at the same time, he's such an obvious, almost self-defeating outsider eccentric that the very nature of his eccentricity keeps him on the margin and maybe then therefore keeps him innovative in one way or another.
What was your reaction when you first started hearing his newer stuff?
The newer stuff? Well, I liked it. I mean, I didn't have a problem of a long-time identification with the older stuff that therefore I had to adjust to get to the newer stuff. I mean, after all, I'm someone who is, unlike strict jazz critics, I am very interested in popular musical forms. So the fact that he would get himself involved with funk and kind of take the innovations of James Brown and Sly Stone and George Clinton and all the disco people and so forth and sort of bend them to his bizarre harmonic purposes and get prime time to play that kind of music, for me, is an entirely progressive and interesting and exciting phenomenon rather than something that is threatening and nervous-making.
It's maybe getting people, too, to not do what you were talking about earlier, which is to dismiss pop music as being just commercial and mass marketed.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I don't have any bias against commercial. It seems to me, look at all the Motown stuff that we all love. I mean, that's strictly commercial music. There is nothing, Theodore Adorno to the contrary notwithstanding, there is nothing inherently evil or trivial about commercially inspired popular art. That doesn't mean that much of it is real good. God knows there's a lot of junk that we encounter on the radio and in the record stores and on MTV and so forth. But fact is that there's nothing inherently wrong with it. And the, of course, if you in some way were shaped by the 60s, which I think all of us were in some way, who are under 45, you have to have sort of in the back of your mind, at least, the kind of optimistic hope that a successful and emotionally meaningful and artistically valid mass art is somehow deeply significant in a gigantic democracy like the United States. If someone whom a lot of people think has quality, e.g. Springsteen, reaches a lot of people, that's good. The fact that Journey also reaches a lot of people is less important, perhaps. But one likes to retain in the back of one's mind at least a kind of affection for the ideal of a quality mass art. And it's hard to sustain that in the late 70s and early 80s with the fragmentation of the radio and record markets and the depression in the pop music business and so forth. Yet, and it's also certainly true that to some extent, Coleman, who's always talking about, quote, trying to get access to the mass system, close quote, is to some extent in your basic kind of Freddie Hubbard kind of way, trying to write a music that will appeal to the masses and make himself a lot of money. Yet at the same time, it's not just to be interpreted cynically. It could also mean that he is in some ideal way trying to reach an audience that he perceives is there and is trying to find mechanisms to get across to it.
Why don't we listen to a couple of minutes of some of his music, and this is from the Of Human Feelings record. We're going to hear Sleep Talk. Want to say anything before we hear it?
Well, just also that people who regard this kind of style as in some way a break from Coleman's past are wrong. I mean, the man got his start playing country blues and dance music in the South. A blues feeling has always informed his music. He has never drifted, even at the heights of the free jazz period, from a kind of roots feeling, and so therefore this roots music is not such a great deviation from his past.
Ornette Coleman from his album Of Human Feelings, and New York Times music critic Joan Rockwell is my guest. We're just talking about how this is described by Coleman's harmonic theory, but nobody knows exactly what it is or what it means.
Including Coleman, as far as I can figure out, but I'm sure that he would deny that, although then he would launch an explanation which we wouldn't understand. So.
A lot of people think that if the music that they really care for that isn't terribly commercial or popular were backed up by record industry promotional money, that the music would reach a wider audience and would become a meaningful popular music. Do you think that that's true with...
I think it's true up to a point. I mean, certainly anything that gets a lot more promotional budget than something else is going to get more sales and attention than it would without that promotional budget. At the same time, there are varying levels of esoteric inaccessibility versus popular accessibility. And if you took, take your favorite example, if you took Anton Webern and gave him the big sell in Variety and Billboard and Billboards on the Sunset Strip and so forth, he would not sell as many records as Christopher Cross does. I mean, you're dealing, people can legitimately feel that if they got more promotion, they would sell more records. But it's not like all records would be equally appealing without any qualifications. And it depends solely on some whim on the part of the people who make these decisions. In other words, they lay their money on the basis of the things that they think will sell. And their simpler, broader, gestured music tends to sell more in a mass society than esoteric, dissonant, obscure music.
Are you ever divided between your intellectual self and your more visceral self and your musical tastes?
I don't perceive it that way. Maybe this is an example of my total self-delusion, but I think to be a music critic, you have to have some faith that the act of intellection about music will contribute to the emotional response to it. That doesn't mean that you have to understand it before you can enjoy it. In fact, it's quite the reverse. You have to enjoy it before you can be impelled or motivated to try to understand it. But once you have developed an instinctive interest in a certain kind of music or a certain piece of music and are then inspired to go out and, you know, read articles or buy books or listen to more music or whatever it is, then it is my faith that somehow the gradual coming to a greater knowledge of this music will amplify and bring resonance to your initial instinctual response. I don't think of them as contradictory either in the abstract or within myself.
Do you use music for different reasons? You know, like some people will use music to create or to change a mood, to make them more cheerful or to...
I tend not to, but I respect people who do. In other words, the whole idea of sort of in a primitive society that music isn't exactly functional. It's used for religious purposes or medicinal purposes or whatever. And in fact, I quote people from the Art Ensemble of Chicago in my chapter on them, expressing a kind of nostalgia for the lost functional nature of music in society and hope that their own music will restore that. I don't myself. I tend to listen to it or to do other things. And I find it very hard to use it as background music of any kind.
I imagine a lot of your listening is determined by what it is that you're to be reviewing.
Sure. I mean, it's the journalistic exigencies. I mean, as I was telling you before the show went on the air, I'm just finished listening to 25 records of Bach's organ music. Well, that took a while.
But given your really musically diverse interests, when you have, say, an hour to listen to something completely for pleasure that is not related to something you're going to be writing about, how do you choose what it is you want to hear?
Blind instinct, and it can vary radically. It just, first of all, you have to understand that, to be frank, that almost at any time there's always something that I feel that in some way I should be listening to.
Right.
If I have an hour, I'll pick up the latest records of whatever they may be it some interesting new pianist playing Chopin or some interesting new rock band or whatever. In other words, there's always something that I can justify in terms of a kind of work compulsion trip to listen to. But even recreationally, if I'm up in the country or something, it's on the basis of instinct and what's around.
What do you say to people who accuse critics of taking the joy out of music by overanalyzing it?
Well, I think that the real problem there is their own misperception of what a critic's task is. A critic is not someone who is telling you what to do. A critic is like someone you know that you've engaged in a conversation with about music that you both might like or have feelings about. And your job as a listener is to develop your own critical faculties. By critical, I don't mean negative carping. I mean discriminatory faculties. And simply use critics as yet another voice in your word-of-mouth process by which you come to your own tastes.
A few years ago, it must have been in 73 or 72, a friend of mine said to me, "You'll see in a few years that I'll be proven right that Neil Young is one of the most important pop singers of our time." Would you agree with that?
Sure. Of course I would. I'm a fan. But I should just make a quick aside here that I know Neil Young as a Canadian. No one has really complained about that, but it's a point I make in the book that it's called All American Music, and here's this guy who's a Canadian, but he's lived in America for 15 years, and I'm told by his manager that he's thinking of taking out U.S. citizenship, but that's not really the point. I mean, the band with Robbie Robertson, et cetera, was as all-American a band as you could possibly imagine, and they were four-fifths Canadian. In any case, as far as Neil Young is concerned, why I put him in the book, I wanted some people from the rock world in there, and I admire Young's music, but the specific reason I put him in the book was that he represents such a wonderful contrast to some of the earlier chapters in the book. One of the points that I make throughout the book is that there seems to be kind of a swing from complexity to simplicity in music of all kinds. And no one is as simple in terms of technical versatility or control as Young. In fact, I know rock studio performers who look down on Young as having a, you know, ugly voice and only about four chords, and he can't really play the guitar. And, you know, I mean, in other words, they don't see anything in him because they are essentially judging the skills of even rock musicians on the basis of technical accomplishment. I find Young's voice, as I do David Byrne's and of Talking Heads in the last chapter, they're both sort of idiosyncratic tenors. Yet I find especially Young's voice to be enormously compelling. I also find his guitar solos and his use of the band Crazy Horse to be compelling in a simple way. In other words, it's a kind of litmus test for your ability to appreciate a kind of primitive simplicity. And even in his new Trans album, which he plays around with synthesizers and vocoders and voice filtrations and so forth, basically he is still a folkishly simple artist. Yet at the same time, I would argue, Young's lyrics and his use of reiterative blues forms and folk blues forms is enormously compelling on an artistic level. That's not to say that anybody who repeats a verse over and over and over again is going to be compelling, but the way he does it is. And I choose in the chapter to kind of concentrate on this song called Cortez the Killer from his Zuma album. It's also on his Decade retrospective album, which I find fascinating, both as an example of his use of guitar solos and a kind of plodding undercurrent of the Crazy Horse people, but for its lyrics, which set up this depiction of European rapine of a kind of femininely depicted new world in the time of Montezuma, and then suddenly, without any warning at all, switch to this suddenly a whole new emotional world in which he's regretting the absence of a lost lover as a contemporary person. And the association of these two, the mythic resonance given to the love affair and the personal immediacy given to the historical fresco, make for, in my opinion, a great rock song.
We'll be hearing that in a second. We're about out of time. I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Do you have a sense of completion having finished this book? Sense of summing up what you think is important?
Well, I suppose to some extent. I mean, I'm a typical person of someone who is always sort of nervously dissatisfied with what they do and wishing it had been better, and also I have other projects in mind. So in that sense, it's not like I'm about to pass on to my reward here. But sure, it's fun to have finished it, and it's fun to be going through the process now of seeing what people think of it.
Well, I enjoyed it very much, and I enjoyed your being here. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me on.
New York Times music critic John Rockwell has been my guest. His new book is called All American Music. It's published by Knopf, and this is the aforementioned Neil Young recording.
Thank you. looking for the new world and the palace in the sun. On the shore lay Montezuma with his coca leaves uncurled. In his halls he often wandered with the secrets of the world. And his subjects gathered round him like the together.